This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Lauren Camp. She is a poet, and her new book is called 100 Hungers. It's winner of the Dorset Prize. She will be doing a book launch this Sunday, the 24th of April at 2 o'clock at Temple Beth Shalom, and will read and then have a conversation with poet Joan Logie. She will also be in Taos on Saturday, the 30th of April at 7 o'clock at Opposite Bookstore, formerly known as Moby Dickens. And she will be in Albuquerque at Bookworks on Tuesday, the 24th of May at 6 o'clock. I also want to say she has a program on KSFR Audio Saucepan that's Sundays at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So this is an interesting book that in many ways goes sort of deep into your own past and your family history, if I read it correctly.
You did. That's exactly right.
Tell us about the origins of this book and the process of going there, so to speak.
So the book tells two stories. It basically ties together, braids together two memoirs. My father's story of growing up in Baghdad, Iraq. He was born in 1935, and he left there in 1950. And my story of growing up with his rituals and customs, the rituals and customs of Iraqi Jews. I knew my story. I lived my story. I wrote my story as a myth. That was how I got into that. I didn't know my father's story. I couldn't really know my father's story. He's alive and would tell me stories about being in America, but not stories about his childhood in any way. And so the way the book came about was a lot of stops and starts, really. A lot of times where I felt like I was banging my head against a wall, waiting for information to land in my lap and realizing it wasn't going to, and starting again and looking for photos. There's not much that's available from that time period, that place, that is, there were blurry black and white photos, but nothing that gave me the sense of a firstborn Jewish male in a country, in a place, in a city that is nothing like what it used to be like.
Right. Why do you think why does he say that he doesn't want to talk about that time?
I really didn't know why. I was able to get some information from some of his relatives, some of his cousins. And what one of his cousins said when I asked, why does he keep pushing me off? Why does he not answer? He said, your father is aloof and lazy. But I don't think either of those things is true. I think my dad never talked about any of it. And I think at some point he couldn't remember.
The whole not talking about it is such an interesting immigrant phenomenon in the United States. I remember years and years ago when I was in my 20s, before my grandmother died, my Sicilian grandmother, I asked her, I said I wanted to interview her about her life. And she looked at me like, why? Are you crazy? Kind of thing.
Yeah, I think there's a whole segment of populations that want to move forward. They need to move forward. Maybe that's the better way to say it. They have to go into the life they're entering. And the book really came about because I started to become really curious only as an adult and as a, you know, like well into adulthood. Why would a family across the world pick up and move to a country and a language and a culture that's not familiar? Why would they do that? That
now,
just doesn't
year,
make sense.
What year are we talking
so
about?
So he left in 1950, and his family was successful in Iraq. The Jews of Iraq, it's funny, it's actually very strange, because I had someone say, so wait, were they Jewish or were they Arabic? And I said they were both. And that same person said, no, but which were they first? And it was, no, they were Jews of Iraq. That was their homeland.
Yeah.
It wasn't that they had landed there and were just there temporarily. They were there generations. So when they left, they were leaving their home. They were, you know, not just their house, but their whole culture. They left in 1950, and his vast extended family left in waves.
And we don't know why?
No, now I know why.
Okay,
why? Now I have a pretty good sense why, thanks to a lot of research. Well, you know, and I've now know the entire history of Iraq.
That's a lot.
It's a lot, yeah. Well, you know, I know all about revolutions and dissent and everything, but I also know something that most people don't know, which is that the Jews were fully integrated into society in Baghdad. More in Baghdad than the other two main cities, which are Mosul and Basra. But they were a third of the population. They were in civic and not so much in government, but in all the other ways of the community. They were deeply involved. They were the merchants. They were just deeply involved in many of the decisions and carried a fair amount of the wealth of the community. That was during the Ottoman Empire, blah, blah, blah. You know, I could like go on and on, but basically at some point there was a British mandate. Britain put territorial limits on it, created a nation state and pushed warring factions together, which were not the Jews. They were the Kurds, the Assyrians, the Shias, the Sunnis. They all started to come too close together. They aligned with Germany. And so when World War II came along, there was that Nazi Germany influence. Ultimately, the Jews left in huge amounts between 1948 and 1950 after the State of Israel was formed.
And many of them went to Israel?
Many of them did. I don't know the percentage. My father's immediate family went to the U.S.
Do you know why they decided to go to the U.S. instead of Israel?
One of my father's uncles came to the U.S. and bought houses for a couple of his brothers. Some of the rest of the family, that was the paternal side of my father's family, my grandmother's side of the family, all went to Israel. There were 8 children in each family. Both my grandparents had 7 siblings, and they just split U.S. and mostly U.S. and Israel.
So you have a lot of relatives.
Oh my God. When we counted my dad's first cousins, we came up with 360 or something.
What?
Yeah. I mean, like just eight siblings, eight and 12 children each. I mean, it was just insane. He's got a very vast family.
And so when you were working on this book and going in through this whole process of, you know, understanding self through family, through background, through history, did you make contact with people you hadn't known before?
No, I didn't. Understand that a lot of this family is older, elderly. A lot are not even alive anymore. Many of them have also moved on. Many of them don't have the same stories as my dad because they were not firstborn males. I was able to get some information from, and each family was different. So I was able to get some information from cousins. Every little bit I got, and I say it that way because there was so little I actually got from family, and even less from my father. Those things became so precious to me that they pretty much went into the book verbatim.
Yeah.
Just because it was like 3 words here and a sentence here. And I was so excited about them. Like my dad's story is really my dad's story, which is particularly interesting because I was writing my story mythologically. Like I didn't mind veering from the truth in that, but I wanted my dad's to be as accurate as I could make it.
Would you like to read a poem?
Sure.
We're talking to Lauren Camp about her book, 100 Hungers.
So I mentioned that there are 2 different threads in the book. There's my story told as a myth. There's my father's story to the best of my imagination, told when he's a boy. And then there are these other poems that I called variations that are sort of what if it had gone differently.
Maybe we can hear one of each of those.
Okay. Let me start with, let me start with a poem about my father.
Okay.
And it's untitled. A prince of the city, he moved through the sky, through the wide eye of sun and the thrust of tough voices, to the pigment of river where he sat with his cousins, eating fish and looking over the season of green, the stone bridge, the bone-white boats, and the long, voluble course of the water.
So place us in...
So that's my dad as probably 7, 8 years old, maybe younger, right at the banks of the Tigris River that curves through Baghdad. And let's see, a poem about me. This is me at 13 years old, 12, 13 years old. It's called Muddy Blood. The first time her thick blood dampened the new moss of her body, the girl opened the door, cloistered inside. Her mother watched as an alphabet of liquid spilled out of her earth, each cramped syllable spreading into an idiom, braised sour red. Her mother taught her to push the storm back into the throne of her swelling and sit like a queen in a kingdom of blood. Later, in the dark, she tasted the salt spoil on the tip of her finger. "Please stop," she said to the ceremonial force of this cyclamen twirling up and inverting her center. But each month her insides descend in diamonds, dashes, and clots, ornamenting sheets with their tangle, the blunt end of pain.
How does that poem, early menstruation, fit in to the sort of larger mythology of your own background, cultural background?
I don't know exactly, except that this was, ultimately the book got paired. I wouldn't say this is an Arabic girl menstruating. I mean, it's a girl. It's just a girl. But, and my mother was not Arabic. And my mother doesn't really enter this book except, I think, right there, or, yeah, you know, one or two places. But I've written about her separately. But it is about my father growing. You know, it starts with the two of us, my father being born and me being born, or, you know, my father's early days and how he comes into the world. And it sort of pairs, like it goes along in pairs in some way, how we grow. And our situations that are so completely different.
You've mentioned a couple of times that your father was the firstborn son. What does that mean to you? What do you think that meant to him?
Being the firstborn male in an Arabic family was, as one of my dad's cousins said, he was a prince. It's different than being the second born or being, he had an older sister. She was just the girl. It's a place of position. It's the place that gives him a specific title in Arabic culture and my grandfather a specific title. They get referenced by the father of, the son of.
Right.
And so it's actually an incredibly important thing to have a boy.
And so to be the child of the firstborn confers something on you also?
I don't think so. I mean, it might have if I, and I am the oldest, but I'm a girl. And I think it wasn't until my brother was born that my father's family was complete. Though I don't know, my dad's been very gracious about it and said, you know, at one point I asked him, did you want me to be a boy? And he said, no, we wanted you to be what you were. So I don't know, but I think had he continued to live in Baghdad, probably the child of a firstborn would probably be the firstborn boy of a firstborn boy would probably be an important position.
When you're doing a book of poetry like this and looking into your past and looking into your family history, and you said you were sort of hanging on every word of history that you got from your father, from your family. It does make one think about questions of accuracy. Like if you're a historian, it's your job to be accurate. If you're a poet, what's your job in that respect?
Some poets want to make things up. I don't mind making things up in poetry, but I wanted to be accurate to my dad's story. And to be honest, I couldn't, because I just didn't have enough information. I stopped writing the book for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months at one point, because I was hitting a dead end every time I came to my dad. I mean, he would just get angry when I asked, like, you know, and say, go ask someone else, go ask this person or that person. Ultimately, I decided that I was going to do the best I could. I wanted a sense of what Baghdad was like. And that took a while, just to figure out what the culture was like, what the sounds, what the smells, what the air, like all of it. Just, you know, ultimately, I tried to be accurate. I hoped I was.
Has your dad read the book?
No, that's a more complicated issue. My dad, in the process of writing this, has developed dementia.
Oh.
So he no longer knows about the book. But the perhaps amazing thing about that, and it's been a very amazingly complicated time with that, but the amazing thing is, in the process of him losing, actually officially now losing memory, he has been talking about stories from his childhood. Now, when before I couldn't get him to open up, now he's opening up, and some of what comes out of his mouth is almost exactly what I've put in the book.
No way.
Yeah, in ways that feel so confirming to me. You know, he was explaining to me about being given this title when he was born. And so, you know, he hasn't said huge amounts that I've put in, but I feel like he would approve if he were able to.
There's a funny moment when dementia comes, when it does come to some people, where all the filters and guards that they had go away and they start saying things.
Yeah.
And some of those things, I mean, they can't remember where they put their glasses, but they remember great detail about the first 15 years of their lives.
Amazing. I mean, I kind of wish I had that information, but in a way it gave me permission to do what I did, you know, to create instead of just to document. It gave me permission to create. But he told me not too long ago about his trip. He traveled by himself from Baghdad to the United States because of a number of factors. And he was telling me about the plane and how it had a bivalve problem on the left side, and how he called his father. I mean, things I've never heard in my life. And, you know, those didn't go in the book because I couldn't have made those up. But it's been kind of amazing to hear his stories.
Do you want to read another poem?
Sure.
We're talking to Lauren Camp about her book, 100 Hungers.
So this is one of those variations that I explained, what if poem, and there are a number of them in the book. It's called Letter to Baghdad. Even if my father never speaks a word of it, I will know he brought a candle, a cough, and the occupied side of his heart. I will know the trees held him, that they rose above roof lines, and where they met, he climbed and saw roads paved only with praises. The sun he shouldered across oceans turned copper at his window. I saw it too, on the gray edge of my childhood, and I was marked when each day awoke. He devoured the silence, the parts that could not be cured, and when he was hungry for it, I swallowed that silence, his self-portrait of confession. When I found an old shawl and silver teapot in the oven and he pretended he didn't know what they meant, I remembered bitter lemons had moistened his mouth. What he inhaled from his copious memory left his tongue empty, then full. And somehow I know his tongue will always be brushed with the leaving. One day we were talking about beginnings, and I had begun. I wasn't at the center anymore, and we kept letting in a little air. And he showed me a word for the boy he once was, and he showed me this Arabic word. And in this way, I knew this was the most authentic morning I would ever see. And I saw it, and he said it again. And we were covered with it, entirely covered. This was his home, he said, as he gave me the address. The place where the first time, and the spurned, and the color, and the milkmaid stood in the alley. And even though he didn't tell me about yesterday, and the day, and the day, and I never saw any other way to tell it, I never saw heaven or the land that was black. One day I knew enough to take the word from him and sip every little thing, every steeped thing. And there were many trees and not enough cold. And we sat by the river that curves in every direction, and our hearts lifted up to the birds.
Lauren Camp, it really strikes me, having spent some time reading through your book and now hearing it, that it's really meant to be heard.
Thank you. I wrote it to the sound of the oud. Actually.
Really?
I really did.
You had music playing?
Playing while I was writing his parts.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. I wanted those long, wailing, you know, stretched out rhythms. And so I was really trying to match that.
So that's what we just heard. Okay.
Yeah. And that's what you heard with the boy poem that I read at the beginning.
Yeah.
Or I hope you heard it. Anyway, that was my goal.
Now, did you have something else playing when you were writing your own parts?
I don't think so. I can't quite remember.
I mean, David Bowie.
Right. Or something American. No, I don't think so. But I can't quite remember.
Yeah.
I mean, I might have had jazz playing because I often do.
What your book made me think about so much was that phenomenon, which so many of us have, of being Americans of mixed descent or of descent from somewhere else and having some access to that but not full access because we weren't born and raised there, we don't speak the language or we don't speak it as well as if we had been born and raised there. And yet things that we don't even know how to articulate are inside us and inform the way we think and act.
Completely. I mean, I think about, I didn't have access to the language was around me. I didn't have access to understanding it.
So you grew up listening to Arabic?
I grew up listening to Arabic in conversation, and I grew up listening to sort of Arabic, maybe recitation of prayers, of Jewish prayers, Hebrew, but with an Arabic tinge to them. So, for example, my father will say a wa sound instead of a V sound. But I didn't understand it. Nobody tried to teach me, and I didn't care to learn. I was busy doing my, jumping rope or, whatever I'm doing.
Right.
As a little American girl. But I also had access to the food, and that mattered, the food and the music. And so all of that got put into the rituals, the family gatherings, the way we were. And so all of that got put into the book.
When you do any of these readings, have you thought of doing readings with the musician accompaniment?
I would love to do that. I haven't yet set up anything like that, but I would really like to do that. I have in the past read with oud, but not this book. So it's already an instrument that I feel, as you said, deeply inside me. Feel it. There's certain foods that I feel deep, that just I would go to at any time. I would be very glad to have lentils anytime, for example.
Right.
Like that just feels comfortable to me.
I noticed that in the book there's different kinds of verse. Some of them are poetry and lines like you're used to seeing, and then some of them look more like blocks of prose.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about the form of the different pieces that you're writing?
In this book, I thought a lot about that prose format. It's not prose per se. It's a poem, but it's It's effectively a prose poem, I guess you would call it. So a block like a paragraph, perhaps a few paragraphs. Part of it was just to shift the rhythm, to interrupt the rhythm, to create a new way of thinking so people wouldn't get lulled into a specific thing. And the book is in five parts where the story keeps almost reinventing new information, different information, different views, which was ultimately the only way I could tell this story. Because I didn't have a straight trajectory of this is what happened to Dad first, and then this, and then this, and then this. And so I think the rhythm is interrupted in many ways. And that prose format was just part of it.
Now, have you gone to Iraq?
No.
Or do you plan to?
Not right now. It's not even really.
No, I know.
It's not recommended.
Yeah.
It has not been recommended for a very long time. My dad's never been back. One of the things I learned when, and I never knew why he'd never been back. I never knew why he never talked about it. It was like this unspoken thing in our family. There wasn't a don't ask me about it. It just, nobody thought to ask. It was like a law that was laid down that this is just not a topic we have any reason to go into. He told me the day he arrived in the U.S. And that was sort of when his life began, or his new life began. He told me what it was like to learn a few words in English. But he never really said anything about what came before, why they left, or how it might have been bad. What I found out was that the Jews had to renounce citizenship. So there was that. He could have traveled back. His father actually went back a couple of times, I think, to finish some business. But my dad never went.
What is it like for you now, having finished this book? Like, do you feel like that history has settled into a different place inside of you?
I've been thinking about that. Like, do I feel like it's complete? And I think the way I set up the book was that it never has to be complete. So when, as my dad's telling me new things, I can think, oh, that's good. And I can just add it to myself, not really to the book necessarily, but to part of who I am, and who he was and what strength he had to come by himself. In a way, every time, this is my third book, and every time I finish a book, the things that are in it feel finalized, maybe, feel, you know, more so than when they appear. A number of these poems appeared in various journals, but until it ends up bound in a book with my name on it, I don't necessarily feel like they're done. And so now I feel like, yes, this is the story. This is the story I created for both of us.
Do you feel like you can move on to like a new body of work?
I have already.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I feel like I'm gathering, I'm writing about dementia. I'm writing about Alzheimer's. I'm writing about other things. I'm writing about living here. I haven't written anything new in a couple of years about my father's history. So in a way I feel like, yes, I have enough on that.
The book is called 100 Hungers, Poems by Lauren Camp. She will be reading this Sunday, the 24th of April, at 2 o'clock at Temple Beth Shalom. Joan Logie, the great poet, will be joining her in conversation. And she'll be in Taos on Saturday, the 30th of April, Bookworks on Tuesday, the 24th of May. And also check out, ladies and gentlemen, Audio Saucepan with Lauren Camp, a wonderful show on KSFR Sundays at 6 in the evening. Lauren, thank you so much for being with us, and congrats on this wonderful book.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design. This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com.